Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm very excited today to be joined by Mauricio Magaldi. It is his third time on the show. He is friend, colleague, and also head of product for Midnight. How are you doing today, Mauricio? You good?
All right, man. Thanks for having me yet again.
Yes. I don't even like this guy. He just keeps turning up. He just keeps appearing in my life, in my work. And look, now we're on the same team. I'm very grateful for that. I feel blessed. I get to work with a guy every day who gets me, who gets to share the same memes that I do, who understands and loves Web3 and blockchain the same way I do. And so here we are today. We are talking about Midnight. More broadly also, the bigger domain of decentralized technology, data protection, and why we have a technology and why we're working with a technology that we think is going to help make things easier, better, and different for Web2 and Web3, for companies, for decentralized applications, for DGens alike. So Mauricio, let's get into it. Why do you feel that data, particularly data or data governance, is an underrated issue at this point in time?
So if we roll back 10, 12 years when we started talking about data as the new oil, remember that, right? And as oil, it's been mined a lot, but not by us. And I think the incentive architecture of this era of the internet actually created mechanisms where we feel fine in just giving away our data. We all live in a digital world, and in exchange to free or discount or freemium services. And we forgot that, and I've written about this at length, if the service is free, then the product is you, right? And this is where we are now. And with the rise of AI scraping for data everywhere, and there's no shortage of it. We've been posting our photos of ourselves as kids, of our kids, of our families, and art that we made, and everything is out for grabs in the internet. And AI is just scraping the internet for that data and training their algorithms and then monetizing, and then we pay to use those things. So I think it's about time we claim data ownership back, and we finally have a set of technologies that allows us to do that in ways that we couldn't before, which are the blockchains. So I really feel that it's only possible for us to have safe, ethical, and marginally correct monetization of data in AI if we partner that with blockchain. So yeah, AI needs blockchains for sure, because it's always all about the data. So we should be able to claim that back as individuals.
That's the kind of the zero verification automation and ownership components, right? The self-custody components of Web3, the decentralized internet, blockchains that enables. And you also talked about monetization, right? It's being able to, at some stage, get fair value for what it is that's yours. I think concepts like Brave Browser or some others, where even Ocean Protocol to some extent, have started to tease the idea that you can be rewarded automatically for contributing something, contributing data, contributing attention, contributing something that's yours or something that you've done to an ecosystem and get repaid. What I don't think we've seen is the Pokemon Go moment, where 300 billion people around the world all suddenly dive into the same browser, because the reward model to an individual probably isn't there. And you talk about some of those incentive structures or some of those business models that may have based themselves on aggregation of data. Maybe the unfair monetization of data that's collected or aggregated, where the value isn't returned necessarily directly to participants. But at an individual level, that's only possible because they've aggregated a very large data set, right? If you think about wearables or devices or mobile phones or telemetry data, right? Hundreds of thousands, millions of people's data, that then becomes incredibly valuable for targeting, for correlation, for information that you can do something with. The individual element of it, I think, is still probably underappreciated or undervalued, or rather it's so undervalued that people don't care. And this is part of the challenge that I see, right? Because when people stop caring, they start doing things like having their first and second name as their ENS address. So then suddenly, every transaction you make with your MetaMask wallet out somewhere in Web3, the second you connect your MetaMask wallet to Facebook, everybody suddenly can see everything you've done ever, providing it's on a public ledger. Or it becomes a lot more easy for people to correlate your data. There's a Web3 example. The Web2 example is, I don't know how many times you personally have sent an image of your driver's license to someone over the internet, a company.
One is already too many, right?
Exactly. But it's become commonplace for us to be taking pictures of our passports, to be filling in forms with more data than is entirely necessary. And for the most part, that's perfectly fine, right? The company on the other end is probably trustworthy. They're probably legitimate. But while that data packet is being sent over the internet, even if it's being stored on the other end, it presents a significant opportunity for hackers, for people who want to steal identities.
Yep.
Right. There was a prolific number of identity fraud cases around people taking out loans, people taking out mortgages, people taking out stimulus checks, because they were able very easily to get the basic amount of data about somebody from a cloud store. You remember that a significant number of images that probably shouldn't have made it onto the internet made it onto the internet as well. These large repositories of sensitive data present a significant challenge, right? For us as individuals, right? I don't want people having my date of birth, address, and so on, because I don't want people taking out mortgages in my name. That's a problem. I don't want to have to go through the courts, hire lawyers, and have to deal with that on the back end. In the same way, companies probably don't want to have to go through the same data governance challenge, right? Is the cost to protect that, the cost to ensure that no one's hacking it, the number of people and staff that you have to. If you look at a bank, I think something that more than 10%, maybe even 20% of the staff in a bank are related to KYC verification and data governance, which is huge. Right? I think IBM came out and said that the average cost of a data hack now for a company, I think this is data from this year, is $4.5 million per hack. Right? If you're a medium-sized business, you're done. That's it. And that's not all necessarily in terms of what the money you have to give back to your customers, but that's loss of business, that's continuity, that's having to hire in emergency consultants, shout out emergency consultants, all of this. There's so much that's pegged to the challenges and the cost and the pain and the burden of this data. And people don't talk about it. Being crazy?
No, I think there's, if you ask any chief information security officer, if you could do exactly the same business you do now, but hold zero data from your customers, where you're implicated, or your suppliers, but you're still being able to do everything you do, would you prefer to hold their data? And I'm sure the answer is going to be no, because if you can, and there's this concept of needs to know basis about data governance. And if you can do exactly the same thing, but not have the cost of carrying the data and protect the data from third party, from clients, from your suppliers and customers, etc., that is a massive, not insignificant amount of cost that goes away. And that's the beauty of applying zero knowledge cryptography into the data space, is that you now can abstract the need to have the data, but you have answers around the data that can be verified. And this is super powerful. And I believe that is a tiny fraction of how we as individuals will get our domain of our data back, is by offering the information that's necessary for us to go on with our lives with businesses that understand the relationship between themselves, the individuals, and their data, and then can make use of that technology to just go along and do their business. So I think not only in terms of eliminating like the honeypots, like you said, the large storages of data that is attracting hackers, but also streamlining the business, right? Because if you have ways to actually perform the same business function without the cost of caring for the underlying data that you now have to protect, and there's like 1, 2, 3 different tiers of security they have to go through, and then there's the physical security and the hardware and all of that stuff, it's a much simpler way for you to carry on with your business and a much better price point. So that is also a matter of efficiency in handling the business.
100%. And we'll get into the benefits of kind of decentralization in a minute. But I remember back in 2016, 2017, very early in my enterprise blockchain career, they were talking about the concept of utilities, of having shared repositories or shared trusted certification of individuals, of companies, of businesses, saying, why is every individual bank or every individual asset servicer KYCing everybody all of the time, right? We've got probably 20, 30, 40, 50% overlap of customer bases in some cases. Why are we all doing this? Why can't we try and create some sort of shared capability where we can rubber walls, reduce down the amount of capacity, the amount of cost that we each have in our businesses, and we'll share information between us? And some of the most ridiculous responses came out to that at the time. It was, no, KYC is a competitive advantage for us. We are the gold standard of KYC. Can you imagine? Can you imagine going into a bank and saying, I like your rates, I like your logo, I like your app's got some really cool features, but tell me about your KYC. Tell me, how am I going to feel when you ask for all of my identity documents? Is this going to be a superb experience? Hashtag superb. No, is the answer. But no. Oftentimes they would use that as a differentiator because they had convinced themselves that they had excelled in bureaucracy to the point that customers would choose them because of how good their bureaucracy was. And this is part of the mindset in industries, and this is a relatively recent example, that those orthodoxies need to be broken, or that the idea that somebody believes that because they've spent $100 million on creating a bureaucracy function, that it should be an advantage.
Yeah, I think there's the whole concept of onboarding a customer, especially in financial services, right? Because there's the paperwork, the KYC. It's not the most pleasant process for users to go through and be onboarded. That the mere idea of changing banks is a hurdle itself. So it is, in a certain way, having a streamlined onboarding with a good KYC would attract because of the ease of use, right? And if everybody else onboard sucks, then you don't move because it's just a burden. But there's this very weird concept, which is a very like Web2 centralized way of thinking, that the user is mine. And we think about that because, as a matter of fact, users' data is ours as companies. We have custodial responsibility to that data in the face of regulation. So what happens is, in Web3, you change the center of gravity. Now, the owner of the data and the owner of the keys are the individuals. And for platforms or businesses to access those, they need the grant from the users. So that is how we achieve ultimate customer centricity, which in Web2 is like, oh, we need to be customer centric, but it's my company for my clients that I own. Get out of here. In Web3, because we're permissionless in nature and we change the ownership keys back to the individual, now the conversation is everybody needs to be customer centric. So the sharing of the data is not just a possibility, is now a customer requirement that companies will need to cater to. So that is shaping how we move along with Web3. Is, if you want to be a company operating in Web3, you have to acknowledge the different paradigm, because now you're subject to the wills and the whims of the individuals because they own their data now. And it's the most beautiful thing, proper customer centricity. We weren't able to achieve that in Web2 because everything's siloed, everything's fragmented. Well, Web3 gives us a way to actually honor that kind of the semantics of customer centricity.
Exactly. You've got the ability for those credentials or that data to move by protocol, as opposed to having had an API that's been custom developed, right?
And owned by a corporation.
Exactly. And so the ability to do interoperability, or the ability to provide that seamless customer experience, is not limited by somebody's technology stack that they've said, no, you may not leave this database, right? Your details may not leave here because we control it, we govern it, we own it. By GDPR, we can give it back to you. We can delete it if we like, but we are certainly not going to share it with our competitors, or we're not, unless regulatorily required to. And open banking did do some of that, right? So we've seen some moves where that oligopolistic, non-anti-competitive behavior has been regulated against. But to some extent, that's not by default. Whereas in Web3, you have standards, you have protocols. By and large, anybody can use those protocols to say, if you have a credential like this, we'll recognize it. We'll allow you to come in based on the details you have. That doesn't mean that you're guaranteed that this credential proves you're over 18, or this credential proves that you've got a certain amount.
No.
But we can get there at an open standards level, which I think is super powerful. What I'd like to touch on next is the difference between data protection and privacy, because I think there's an important distinction. And we've seen with some examples like Tornado Cash over the last little while, that generally speaking, the 99% of the world, which is not the 100,000 angry degens on Twitter, or the kind of anonymous cypherpunk movement, which more power to them, I'm not saying that their choices are invalid, quite the opposite. But the way that the world is wired today is wired for some degree of transparency or some degree of compliance requirements. Right? We live in countries, they are governed by governments, there are rules. Within those rules, there is some requirement to disclose something about yourself, to pay taxes so that municipal services can be afforded, to protect minors so that only people of a certain age are able to do certain things, driving, carry guns, drink alcohol, all the fun stuff. The government wants to regulate your fun. But by and large, those rules are there and they're not going away. And so I think it's foolish for anybody to consider that technology will replace the rule of law or replace the kind of the role of governments at this point in time. And so imagining a world where technology makes us anonymous, gives full privacy, complete anonymity all of the time, is probably somewhat misguided. How do you think about data protection in that context? Right? How does it sit differently to you?
One of the perks of being old is you start to think about everything as a spectrum. Very few things are binary, like the response to a ZK verification is binary. But if you think about data privacy or data protection as a spectrum in full data publicity and complete data privacy, there is a spectrum. So data protection in ways that are aligned to regulation or aligned to a framework that enables an individual or a company to protect the data that is near and dear to them, like PII, personal identifiable information, or trade secrets, or pricing strategies, or cost of goods, say in retail, which is completely strategic information. That is something that you can use for a transaction, but you must protect, right? If you know who you're dealing with, which is one layer of privacy, but only the two of you peer-to-peer know who you're dealing with, and if anyone else who's not involved in that transaction won't know this, then there are layers of that you might put in place to protect that information. And there are mechanisms that you can put in place to allow that transaction to be compliant to a, say, data privacy regulation. The reason why we had the emergence of data privacy regulation across the world was clearly misuse of data. It was a point in time where we were subject and we as individuals were trained and incentivized to give away our data willy-nilly just to get access to a new photo sharing app. And then that became a problem because of data leakage, that became a problem because of misappropriation of data, and that became a problem because there is no way to recover the data once that's out into the world. So GDPR in Europe, LGPD in Brazil, and many other countries have similar things. The US has quite a few different privacy, they call it privacy laws, but data protection is a spectrum. So you have to, according to your jurisdiction, as you said, we still live in countries have jurisdictions, you have to be able to actually protect the data that must and needs to be protected, but also to make the rest of the data that doesn't fluid, because there's a lot of opportunities on all of the other data. When we talk about composability and permissionlessness in blockchains, it's about the data. You can't compose a new business rule unless you see the data from the tokens on another smart contract. So there are implications for you if you make everything private versus making everything public. So there's also a spectrum. So if there's a possibility for us in the Web3 world to manage as we develop and operate an application on chain of what I want to be very strategically private and obscured from the world and very much public, because then it creates more business opportunities, both for me, my users, and the rest of the ecosystem, you can choose. That is what I would consider the holy grail of Web3. We are now able to partner data privacy regulation and compliance to the ability to be composable and permissionless at the same time. So that is maybe that's the hat trick.
And Charles Hoskinson calls it programmable privacy or programmable data protection. It's the spectrum idea is the best analogy I've heard for it, which says that you have an application, it's going to try and do a whole bunch of different things. And some of those things are maybe regulatory required or compliance required to be transparent. Or might be that you, like you said, deliberately choose to be transparent around your carbon footprint or around certain compliance checks that you've done so that the external world can verify, right, without having to trust your brand, can verify that something has happened, that you have appropriately offset carbon for a particular transaction, or that you have appropriately verified the individuals. You don't have to share their data though, right? So that we are being transparent with the things that we have to, but we are shielding the data, protecting the data everywhere else, and building on what we said before, that in this part here where you're shielding, as much as possible, you're trying to avoid actually passing sensitive data from one party to the other over at the internet. And that's, we'll get into the how that happens later. It's delivered in a quite complex way, but I think it's explained a very simple way. And so when we talk about data protection, it's really saying we're not against compliance. We are not here for complete anonymity. Also, at the same time, if you think that Web3 and blockchains are providing you anonymity at this point in time, that's not really the case either. You have pseudonymity. So you have wallets that are a series of letters and numbers that, for the most part, are transparent in everything they do. On the large majority of blockchains that we transact in, you can see the address, you can see the counterparty, you can see the metadata around the transaction, time, date, platform, smart contract used, value exchanged, cost of gas, et cetera, et cetera. And from that metadata, you can correlate a huge amount of things. I think it's something like 7 data points and Chainalysis can find you as a person, not you as a wallet, you as a person, which is, I don't know whether that's hype or whether that's over the top, but if Chainalysis can, that means the CIA can, which means anybody else who's got somebody who's worked in one of these sorts of agencies can probably do the same. At which point metadata and correlation of data should be part of your thought set as well. So if we're already not worried about having anthony.day.eth, right, then we should be worried on top of that about where am I connecting my wallet to, or where am I plugging in my email address. We're already okay that Google gets to see all of the places we sign into. So they're building up a profile
and,
about us.
And our emails and our documents.
Yeah, right? And I think it's going to be challenging in 2023 to say, you know what, I'm not going to go with Google. I'm going to completely go off grid from Google. I think it would be hard to work in workplaces. And that's probably one of the necessary sacrifices we have to take. But then with our Google, we should, or Google Mail or whatever else it is, we should be trying not to send driver's licenses, bank details, receipts, and all of that, and storing that in our email address because, again, honeypots, correlation of data, et cetera, we've got a risk. The same exists in Web3, and up until now, people haven't really realized the importance of that. You know, people not realizing the implications if they connect their MetaMask or whichever other wallet to Facebook or to Instagram or whatever else. The second you do that, they have got both your social media profile and everything you've ever done in crypto. And I think it's important for us to let people know that is something that an organization like Facebook or Meta is able to derive once you connect your wallet. In fact, any organization where you connect your wallet, where you're sharing that wallet address in and above any additional detail, is going to have the same access to the same data. And so be mindful as to where and when you do that, because that's the data you're giving away. Everything that you've ever done with that wallet, every wallet that wallet has ever been connected to, everybody you have ever sent a Doge to, same kind of story. Let's stop with the scaremongering for a second though, because I'm not saying that data is bad. We're really just saying that be mindful of the concept of data protection and think about how much you're prepared to do or how much you're prepared to share and what the alternatives are. Because the good news is now there are some alternatives. Let's talk about decentralization. Because this is something that you and I have been on I wouldn't call it a quest per se, but we've certainly been on the journey together through different paths of appreciating that there is a different way of building technology. Decentralized infrastructure is part of that. The decentralized internet is a growing domain where things happen, applications are built, people transact, people connect with each other. There is this kind of blossoming part of the internet, which is more decentralized than it is currently. how do you talk about the importance of decentralization when you're talking to somebody who has never come across crypto and Web3 before, or an enterprise who's been building, I don't know, on-premise enterprise applications or cloud-based applications for their entirety of their lives? How do you talk about the concept of decentralization and why it matters, or how it can help?
Yeah, I think I look at decentralization more like a paradigm rather than just an architecture.
I thought you were going to say spectrum again, but go with paradigm.
And it is a spectrum, because you can be more or less decentralized. It's also not a binary thing, but it is a new paradigm. You have to understand the implications, especially if you're in technology and like IT, and understand that the decentralization will happen at different rates or at different points in the spectrum across a whole stack. It could have decentralized businesses running on top of decentralized infrastructure, but you can have centralized or more centralized businesses running on top of the same decentralized infrastructure. As a spectrum, it serves different use cases at different layers of the stack. So think, if you have like a browser that is fully decentralized, imagine knowing that the decentralization is one of the corners of the trilemma. How long do you think that the fully decentralized browser is going to take to load, right? So we'll probably look across both vertically and horizontally to understand what it is and how it applies. But more importantly, as a paradigm, means that you now are giving away a little bit of control to have a lot more resilience and a lot more trust in your infrastructure. And it's also something that most CTOs or CIOs are not willingly going for.
It's a scary prospect, right?
It is.
It's a big change.
It is. We're moving towards decentralization. If you think about the financial services, we've seen the open banking movement across the world. It started in the UK, but it's been done well in Singapore, Brazil, and other places. And open banking means giving back the data control to the users and giving the ability of the users to use any particular financial services in that jurisdiction they can connect to. And the decentralization is pretty much orchestrated by APIs. Like, they are standardized, they move the data back and forth, they have security clearances and all of that stuff. But they're still centrally owned. Each API is centrally owned by an entity. In the decentralized paradigm, what you have is a whole infrastructure where once you deploy, you can actually leave it running. And every time your application is activated by someone, it's going to run exactly the same, right? So the ability for you to actually deploy we call them dApps, right? The decentralized applications, when they are running on a decentralized infrastructure, are very powerful. And obviously, the decentralization also means that you have no central point of failure, which is very dear to most technology people that I know. If you go to any financial services company, and sorry that I am going back to financial services, that's my original industry, but you have redundancy everywhere. And every time you have the redundancy, you have twice or three times the cost, and you have to have it in different locations. You have to have it, like, it's you centrally owning a portion of your decentralization that you have to pay for. When you're running on a decentralized infrastructure, you share that, especially if it's a decentralized infrastructure that is multi-purpose, it doesn't serve only a single use case, then you share the infrastructure with everybody else. Yes, there will be competition for resources because block space in decentralized infrastructure is limited, but you get to use it. And if you plan accordingly, you get to use it whenever you need. So that is, I think, one of the biggest advantages in my mind is the lack of central authority, which brings the decentralization. The fortitude is having no central point of failure. Mm. If you think about that in the world of blockchains, we've seen a lot of exploits, right? I haven't heard of an exploit that is on the blockchain. There was maybe one very famous early on in the history of blockchains that forced a rollback in one of them. But after that, we haven't seen it. And what we see is bridges getting exploited, smart contracts at times being exploited, both in hacks and in logic.
Which is a bit like saying you've had a phishing attack or your application has a bug, right? And so the application didn't work.
Yeah.
The fact is that
But the internet keeps going. The internet keeps going.
Exactly. Right. Exactly that. And that's the helpful analogy for me is if we can break it down simply, we talked about the ability to have infrastructure that's always on. Right? It's up 24/7. It's very hard, if not impossible. Well, it's not impossible. It's never impossible, but it's incredibly hard to hack, take down, or to have to a sort of denial of service on the underlying infrastructure. That's not something that most people in the Western world had to deal with every day. But there are places in the world where the internet goes off, where server farms go down, where continuity of businesses' websites, continuity of their EDI systems, continuity of critical infrastructure for them isn't reliable all of the time. And so that's a part of it. The ability to deploy smart contracts, what you would call decentralized applications, the ability to have your application run on unstoppable infrastructure and globally. The cost to deploy that globally and the cost of deploying that being very little for the most part. Okay, Bitcoin and Ethereum at peak time, maybe less. Okay, you don't deploy smart contracts on Bitcoin yet.
After Taproot is possible, but yeah.
Yeah, the BitVM paper came out this week, so everyone's quite excited about very expensive smart contracts on Bitcoin right now. But park that for the moment and come back to applications that can run globally, always on, can be deployed for very little cost, that are open and transparent. So for the most part, anybody can connect with them. Anybody can copy them. Anybody can validate the what's there. The connectivity of this sort of infrastructure, I think, is incredibly powerful, as opposed to having to do versioning of APIs or to have kind of micro consortia, as we've seen with some of the early private distributed ledger solutions. The versioning and the updates and the constant management of what's happening at a micro level between 5 or 6 or 7 parties is very hard. Imagine then you've got hundreds of thousands of people transacting. That becomes a very unwieldy system to manage. And so if the protocols can be universal and standardized, that makes things generally a little bit easier. The ability, like you said, for transparency. Right? If you write something onto the internet, if you write it onto a social media application or something like that, those can be edited. Those can be taken down. Those can be hidden. Those can be censored. Or they can just be taken down because they don't align with whatever the policy was at that particular time. Right? The control is whichever the platform is. If you're mentioning or you're reporting your financial data, in reality, all you're doing there is you're sharing your spreadsheet to somebody who is going to put your spreadsheet on the internet, which is less reliable to some extent than being able to say in real time, we are pushing machine data to a decentralized network that is very hard to take down. And so the level of integrity of that data can also be considered to be much higher for certain applications.
Yeah. And I like the fact that when we think about the decentralized paradigm and then obviously the decentralized architecture, this concept of always on is native to it. For the longest time, and we still have markets that shut down, right? On the weekends, and you can't do business on specific times of the day or the week or days of the week. When you're running a truly natively digital, decentralized, always-on global infrastructure that is maintained on the sheer force of incentives to participate, it's really hard. Incentive architecture is very powerful. We're still very human, although we're very much digital. But incentive architecture and game theory, more importantly, is what make these decentralized infrastructures so resilient. We're still animals of habit, so subject to our own nature. So it's interesting to see how these things play a part in ensuring that not only it doesn't fail on a single point, but it also stands and runs as it's been designed, because the incentives are there to circularly retrofeed into it and ensure that the security is maintained. So it's all a beautiful design.
It is. We're starting to get a little philosophical. It's going to bring you back down to earth for a second. For those out there who are interested in the concept of using decentralized applications, the decentralized internet, hopefully there was something in there for you. But we are going to talk now more specifically about Midnight and the why to start with, right? Simon Sinek says always start with why. As a result, Iran, our boss, says always start with why. And it's a very important way to start, because I think for most of Web3 and for most of blockchains, they started with what? This is a fantastic blockchain that is fast, cheap, green. You are going to have programmable applications that can run decentrally on infrastructure. And suddenly the other guy's like, that sounds really difficult, really technical, really hard. Tell me why that matters. And so I think when I think about why I joined Midnight, why when Iran or Charles Hoskinson started talking about the technology, having been relatively familiar with blockchains for the last 8 years, having heard the guys talk about, okay, the blockchain technology is cool, right? We've been building on this, or we've been working on this for 5 years nearly. The elliptic curve cryptography we're using is incredible. The zero knowledge is spectacular. The way that you can have the different components, and we'll get into that, is, you know, unlike what we've seen in the market so far, unlike other blockchains or other technology architectures have provided before. Like, let's park that, right? Because there are some higher order issues that we can observe in the world that are only getting bigger. And at the moment, the world, the internet, and organizations are not dealing with them well, right? So we talk about there being a huge proliferation of data, right? Take whichever thought leader you follow, but it's zettabytes and pogabytes, or I can't remember what the next level up is, but there are very many bytes of data being created every single day, and it is not declining, right? We've started with data created by the internet, and then everybody started having a smartphone. Eventually, you start having IoT devices, smart vehicles, and so on and so forth, robots in our home at some point, if Elon has his way. The amount of volume of data that we create, the more sensors that we are creating in the world, are growing exponentially. And I'm pretty sure we've covered in the front end of the show why data governance is expensive, challenging, and difficult. And the more that we architect systems in a way which data is being sent over the internet to other parties who have to then govern it, store it, hold it, and maintain it, that's not going to be a way that the humanity can sustainably manage its internet in future, right? I think thing one, we know that people today are not particularly good at governing their own data. And we need to find a way of helping them to not have to do that themselves, right? I don't know how many GDPR requests you've ever put in to say, please remove my data. But I haven't yet, even though I'd love to. It just feels impenetrable. It's like, that feels like I'm dealing with the gate after the horse is bolted. You've already got my data. And if you were going to do something nefarious with it, you would have done it by now. Right? So that's part of it. The fragmentation, the silos that you talked about in terms of different companies managing different pockets and honeypots that different organizations may be able to try and penetrate depending on how good or how not good that organization's security is at one particular point in time, or whether or not one of the employees is an insider, or whether there's a phishing scam that somebody gets catfished at some point in time. It's a kind of a lottery as to which honeypot with my data is going to get hacked next. And that will only continue if we continue to architect systems in the way that we have today. The cost of those hacks, I'm not just talking about consumers here, right? This is a B2B issue. Hacks of important sensitive data. Any database hack can be terminal for any business, right? Whether you're an airline, whether you're an e-commerce provider. If you lose the goodwill, government, you lose the goodwill of your customers, it's going to be very hard for you to win it back unless you're in some sort of monopolistic position. And so what's at risk for businesses looking after their customers, their suppliers' data, intellectual property is everything at the same time, right? The challenge with being able to share your data with a larger party in a supply chain. If you look back at a platform that IBM built for Renault back in the day, the car manufacturer, part of that was demonstrating, could they have suppliers? They've got second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh tier suppliers. They're so far away from those guys that it's very difficult to track, but they need to make sure that the materials quality or the commitment to materials quality from that seventh tier aggregates all the way up to the sub-assemblies and sub-assemblies and so on. And being able to maintain a single view across all of that was super important, rather than having it in fragmented systems that you can't audit. At the same time, these suppliers are going into a procurement system with a huge OEM, right? One of the biggest multi-billion dollar companies in the world. And they're sharing, oh, here's our secret recipe for how we build something. And we would like to win business with you, sir or madam. We would like to build 100 million widgets for you, and here's how we're going to do it. And anybody further up the supply chain could look at that and say, oh, that's a really interesting specification. Hey, preferred supplier over here, could you do that and make that cheaper? Oh, okay, cool. Off you go. When you're committing to RFP or procurements, the challenge of demonstrating that you are compliant, that you can operate within the parameters of what's being asked for without sharing your IP, right? Let's take this to KFC and Coca-Cola at the same time, right? Those secret recipes are secretly and heavily guarded. I don't know how many billions of dollars are spent on protecting that secret recipe of 24 herbs and spices. I don't eat chicken, so I'm not really the guy to know on this one. But again, that's something that is the intellectual property that is shared between parties is commercial secrets, can be copied. Equipment manufacturers, the speed at which their technology can be reverse engineered and shared elsewhere. Anything that gets put into a 3D printer that's OEM parts can be reverse engineered very quickly, right? And so the issues in that space, 3D printing, remember that? 10 years ago, that was everyone's going to have a 3D printer and we're going to be printing mice in the corner of our home or something, or ears. I think everyone's going to be printing ears in case their ears fell off.
Or ears in mice. Or...
ears on mice, exactly Whichever, wherever the mood takes you of a Sunday afternoon. That probably hasn't fulfilled its promise from a consumer perspective, but from a manufacturing perspective, from the industrial metaverse or the industrial landscape, huge. And these spaces are where the billions of dollars are being spent on protecting IP. So probably a note to those listening in, that this is not a conversation about B2C exclusively. This is a conversation about everything, everywhere. Enterprise applications, consumer applications, all applications. This story is relevant. And we're constantly trying to keep up with, or rather regulators are constantly trying to keep up with the pace of technology and presenting or delivering compliance requirements in different industries and different jurisdictions that, again, leads to that further silo creation or data governance spaghetti that becomes incredibly complex to manage and incredibly expensive. And the more we regulate or the more we add compliance, we're not doing it from a streamlined perspective. We're just layering stuff on top of stuff on top of stuff until the point that it becomes almost impossible to manage profitably unless you are very large and can afford the cost of compliance. And so put all that together, right? And you say, well, this is the world that we're living in. This is the world in which we're trying to build applications. This is the world in which we're trying to enable technology to make things better. And all of these things are making it worse. From the simple perspective that we are sharing sensitive data on the internet.
Yep.
Right? If we can take away this bit in the middle, which is the sharing sensitive data on the internet bit, and architect applications differently, I'm not going to say all of this goes away, but the challenges and the costs and the burdens of the governance for the data that you don't need to manage becomes materially different. And that was the why, that was the wow moment for me, is like, yeah, we just take the horse out of the picture and add a combustion engine. And suddenly the world looks like a different place. Right? Take the sensitive data out of the picture and work with proofs. I don't know whether you felt the same why or you have a different why, but that's how I think about it.
Yeah. No, I think I agree. I think the one thing that maybe is different is the reasoning in my mind, right? When I think about, so I started in crypto with the Bitcoin white paper, then I learned about Ethereum, but I started working professionally with blockchain in the context of enterprises, right? I've been in financial services my whole life. I was on an enterprise service provider. Those were enterprise clients. They had enterprise requirements. Bitcoin, Ethereum at that point, we're not catered to that or any other blockchain. And then we saw the emergence of private blockchains that were trying to solve the same problems, but keep a privacy to some extent. That proved very hard to be successful because the incentive architecture was very hard to come by because you were starting to partner with competitors and we're starting to partner with suppliers that competed amongst themselves. Like, it was all competition and no collaboration. And maintaining a proprietary infrastructure in that fashion is really hard. So we saw many examples on that in the last years. So I still have that, although I'm a degen, I still have that mindset and that frame of mind in the background. And we know that scale of things happen through enterprise. It's just the way capitalism works, right? So when thinking about data privacy in that context and data protection, one thought that occurred to me was like, if we didn't have the abundance of data, especially sensitive data that's being put out into the internet in the last 20, 30 years, the existing technologies and business models that we know would never have happened. And the advancement of society, humanity, technology wouldn't be where we are today. What if, instead of giving away all of that data, we could have selective disclosure of that data or the information associated with that data that would still sustain the businesses and the advancements that we had in the last 20, 30 years, but without the compromise on data privacy that we suffered entirely in the internet generation through those decades. We might have been even further because there would be less concern about, are we protecting our data? Is there a legislation of sorts forcing us to abide to it? No, we could be focusing so much more in solving the problems rather than milking the data. And I think that's what kind of clicked. So when I say that this combination of managing public and private state of the data as you transact in the new internet of ownership is the holy grail of the blockchains. That is what I'm talking about, is continue to enable businesses to flourish without damaging the underlying data of the individuals that consume those businesses. This is unique and very powerful. So striking that balance to me was like, okay, I want to be in on it because I've seen this happen. I've seen other attempts. And if we can balance those things out, that is a very interesting story to tell. Yeah, that is the why. And I think that pursuing the right combination of technologies with the right ethos, with the right work ethic, is something that is, it makes a lot of difference. Because we've seen a lot of great technology being used poorly, especially in the last year, right? So I think we're being able to offer that for people to actually build sound businesses that can flourish without damaging or compromising data is quite a, it's a tall order, but it's quite a great call to be associated with.
It's a pretty nice recipe to be able to work with, right? It's saying that we're going to find a way to reduce the compliance or the data governance burden by not passing it directly. We're going to enable scalability and transparency of apps by using a decentralized architecture that's possibly going to have benefits around the cost to maintain or cost to support as well. We're going to have some availability benefits there. We're going to be more customer centric in what we create. We're going to enable third parties to build with us as opposed to for us to have to build everything ourselves as a way of architecting whatever comes next for the internet. I think that becomes incredibly powerful. And in the same moment, you also unlock the kind of digital identity and automation at the same time there, because back when we talked about anthony.day.eth, right, that's going to be a troublesome digital identity to have for a very long period of time. And in reality, that's just going to break down at some point. But if you're an organization that has multiple vehicles, multiple accounts, multiple individuals who want to use these applications, if you can support machine identities that can run with proper transparency and proper shielding of data in an autonomous system, you're going to be able to scale that and build that much, much faster. You're not going to be fearing that your IP or your location address or the metadata around your entire fleet of vehicles or a number of sensors in a particular facility, manufacturing facility, in a farm or in any sort of production setting is going to be visible to my competitors or visible to my whoever wishes to do me harm. Or that I can be transparent with my insurance company so that I can get the cost of operating down because I can share telemetry data, but without sharing everything to everybody all of the time. That unlocks a whole bunch of innovation that at the moment is becoming a little bit more challenging because it goes through closed cloud servers and closed application architectures that are harder to innovate on or harder to scale on top of. That's the kind of the good news for the technology side. Why don't we tell the guys how we do it? Because I've been very deliberately holding the what is it back, or trying to hold the what is it back, because we don't want to be those guys saying, let me tell you about smart contracts. You're going to get very, because the rest of blockchain started with, let me tell you about a blockchain, right? Let me tell you about consensus. Let me tell you about block time. Let me tell you about smart contracts and changes of state and virtual machines. And everybody either thought they were in some sort of bizarre Matrix movie, or for the most people, it was unrelatable and they switched off. Like, that doesn't sound like a problem I have. I've never asked for a smart contract. I don't need my contracts to be smart. I just talk to my lawyer. That's not
if
something.
If it's contracts, just get the lawyer in.
Exactly. We've done a poor job of helping people relate and become excited about this evolution of the internet by describing it poorly or not allowing empathy to build up front before we then start using the technical jargon afterwards, which even in that, we still need to try to pare it down a little bit. And we will try now. I will try to pare you back if we get too technical. But give me the best version of a modestly technical, not overly complicated version of what is Midnight and how does it work?
I'm going to try, but you have to bear with me that Midnight is a blockchain.
I've got your back if you fuck it up.
Right?
I'm here for you.
We're building a blockchain. Well, we're building a blockchain that caters to use cases that we just discussed. I think that's the easier way to understand this. It's a blockchain that will allow you to build decentralized applications while managing public and private state of your data as you run your business rules through a smart contract.
All right, hold on. You went jargon there, so I'm going to do the translation.
Yes, okay.
Okay, I'm going to try and do the translation. Let me tell you if I get it right. We are going to create some infrastructure, cloud-like infrastructure, that allows you to build applications on top of it. You can choose the logic that happens in your application, the things that happen in your application. Those can be public for everybody or shielded from anyone, including the person you're transacting with or the person that your counterparty in the application is there with. And you as an application developer can choose where on that spectrum you want to set things to be public or shielded. Was I close?
That sounded more like a human person speaking. Like
I'm trying. I'm really trying because I care to get this right. I don't want to say
we are
the fourth generation of blockchain and we're bringing even worse jargon. Right.
Yeah. No, the jargon is something that certainly keeps us away from most things. And I'm going to tell you, it took me a while to catch on with the zero knowledge thing because I don't know what it is. I have zero knowledge about it anyway. So let's skip it at that.
Again, that presents a challenge for us because zero knowledge in my book has been a domain that's been in fairly broad visibility, at least in Web3, since about 2016. I want to say, right, back in Deloitte days, we were going to zero knowledge conferences and everyone would say, this is the next thing. And the unfortunate part of it is that it is relatively complex math and cryptography that is developed by utter gigabrain geniuses. And the same way that the intelligent engineers who build blockchains struggle to communicate with empathy, the same thing is for mathematicians and cryptographers. And so the simplest way I can describe a zero knowledge proofs is you're creating a proof of data rather than passing the data itself. So you're saying rather than me sharing, you don't need to know how this works. We can go through the steps of it, but the shorthand of this is rather than me sending you the driver's license, I'm sending you a proof I'm 18. So rather than passing the data from an application over the internet that has to be stored and managed and maintained, rather than passing that sensitive data, I'm just sending you a proof that the system can validate is true of something. I'm over 18. I am from a non-sanctioned screened country. The specifications that I have entered into this particular procurement exercise match with what is required, or that the specification in your chemical compounds match with regulatory required XYZ, or that a trusted authority has issued a certificate of education, training, qualifications that is sufficient for you to enter this facility.
Yeah.
Sending a proof, right? I'm giving you a green light or a red light. And that's all my application does now. And no sensitive information leaves my laptop. No sensitive information leaves my computer.
My application.
The green and red light leaves.
Yep.
Right. And so that's proofs for me is we send proofs. Yep. We don't send data.
Yeah. And interesting, you can actually think of pretty much any business process where the information is actually more powerful than the data that's underlying that information. So if it's a binary yes or no, one or zero, in computing, it's not a whole string of data. It's just one byte. So even if you think about processing everything, even though you have cryptography running and producing proofs and obviously verifying the proofs, the burden of actually handling the return of that, it's not the whole string. It's just a yes or no, and you can move on to your life, right? So those are rather simple ways of handling the information without having to touch the data. And then that's how we achieve data protection. We share the data. It helps you move on with your business, but you share the information, help you move on with your business. We never share the data. And this is, again, this is yet another paradigm.
There we go. And I've just realized we've been getting carried away with decentralization and data and trying to keep it simple. We've got 2 minutes left. Jeez. And so with those 2 minutes, we got to let the people know, how can they get involved with Midnight, right? How can people find out more about what Midnight is, why we're here, and more importantly, how can they get working with the technology?
Yeah, we're so pleased to have opened registration for the DevNet. DevNet is a first iteration of Midnight available for developers. So if you're a builder in this space, if you're interested in zero knowledge proofs, if you're interested in blockchains and building decentralized applications, you can go to our website, it's just midnight.network, midnight.network. And there is a form there that you can register, and 100 teams will be selected for the first wave on this. Almost, DevNet is like a sandbox for developers at this stage. You get to experiment, we're building with the community. So we certainly expect the feedback to come, and we're going to work with you to get you going. There's access to our experts during the DevNet experience. So it's going to be fun, educational, entertaining, and more importantly, productive, because this is a new Web3 paradigm, and builders are going to be more than central to how we deliver the mission of Midnight across the new internet. So it'd be great to see you guys joining.
There we go. So in summary, DevNet, developer network, a private beta where we're releasing early functionality. It's not the final Midnight mainnet. That's coming later. It's not perfect. We want your feedback. We want you to build with us. We want you to tell us, what are you going to be using proofs for? What kind of applications do you want to rewire to improve data protection? What are some of the features that you like? What kind of libraries do you want to see? What functionality makes the developer experience or the user experience of working with Midnight as a data protection blockchain better? Important note, there are limited spaces on DevNet, right? We do not have 100,000 in our developer relations team to be able to support everybody all of the time. So there are a limited number of slots if you want to be part of the DevNet and the first cohort. So please do get your application into midnight.network. Go apply there. You'll go through the form. There's some stuff to fill in. And we'll be selecting relatively soon the first cohort of users for Midnight DevNet. So if above and beyond that, please do follow us on LinkedIn. Midnight is out here. Midnight-network with no vowels because naming. And also check us out on Twitter. Midnight Network is available on Twitter or X, where we're putting all of the latest updates, all of the latest releases, videos from Charles Hoskinson. And please do keep sharing ideas, suggestions, feedback. We welcome it, and we can only get better with your support. So, Mauricio, muy obrigado. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Looking
very
forward
much
to
for
the fourth
show.
One.
Yes. As CZ would say. See you later, guys.
See you.
Thanks again for listening to the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast. As always, opinions in this episode are mine and those of my guests alone. If you want to find out more, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out some of the other episodes on the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast, and check out the YouTube channel, also called Blockchain Won't Save the World. Stay safe out there.